You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Finally on the show today, producer Jack Marshall speaks to Austin Mitchell about the rise, fall and consequences of neoliberalism. Jack.
So I started off by asking Mitchell why he had focused both on Britain and New Zealand.
Well, they're both very similar in the sense that both have been very closely dependent. I mean, New Zealand was in effect Britain's South Pacific farm, and the two economies were closely connected. New Zealand supplied food, Britain supplied New Zealand with manufactures and so on and so forth. So we had a common history and had been very close to each other, and we benefited both countries from the post-war settlement. The post-war settlement was a new society meant to compensate the people for the efforts and the sacrifices of war, and it ran the economy along Keynesian lines with Keynesian demand management for full employment and jobs and a welfare state and steady economic growth. Now, that was a good society, and both countries enjoyed it for 30 years. The French call them les trente glorieuses, but they were 30 good years. The years have never had it so good for England and for New Zealand. But then in the 70s, the settlement began to fall apart. We had balance of payments problems. Both countries had balance of payments problems. And there was a horrendous inflation problem, which was caused by the increase in the Arab oil price. That marked the death knell of the post-war settlement, because people came along with new solutions. One of those new solutions was neoliberalism, and that was the one that was taken up by Mrs. Thatcher, who came to power in Britain in 1979, and by Roger Douglas as part of the Longy Labour government, which came into power in New Zealand in 1984. Both marched down the same path, and both made the same disastrous mistakes.
It's funny you mentioned Roger Douglas, because at the restaurant I work at, Roger Douglas actually came in the other night. And the funny thing about even as disastrous as his politics kind of may have been, he's actually a lovely guy. But so I was wondering, one of my favorite quotes actually in your book is, "Oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them." And so that quote there makes me think of actually the UK recent elections. You've got Mr. Jeremy Corbyn. And so I'm very curious as to what your take on Jeremy Corbyn, kind of where the election's going, because he has radically different approaches to kind of what we see in today's kind of parliamentary system.
Yeah, sure, you're right. I mean, I think the belief has been up to now that governments win elections or parties win elections by appealing to the middle ground, in other words, the kind of mishy-mashy centre ground of people with weak ideologies and who are disinclined to vote, fairly apathetic about the whole business. What you've got to do is win them. Now, all of us, me included, made the mistake of thinking Jeremy is a hopeless leader, a nice man, a great pusher of causes, but not an election-winning leader. And we thought, therefore, that he wouldn't appeal to the centre ground, and Labour would be disastrously defeated. The government thought that. That's why they caused the election. The newspapers thought that. All the pundits thought that. I thought that. And we were wrong. And I think what's happened has been that this peasant revolt I talked about, people on the centre ground have been so clobbered by cuts, by the fact that their living standards haven't improved in 20 years, because take-home pay hasn't gone up, and they've had to keep up their standard of living by increasing debt, so everybody's hung down with greater debts than they can support, and there hasn't been any strong economic growth, not in this country, and people are just fed up of it. And that's what we didn't take into account. They voted to express the fact that they felt left behind, the government hadn't delivered to them, things had to be changed. And it has produced change. It's got Cameron and Osborne, who were the architects of austerity, fired. It's got a new government. It's got a government which says it's prepared to borrow more, to spend more, to stimulate the economy, to grow. And the atmosphere has changed. We made a mistake. We thought that the old terms still worked and that the old rules still lingered. And they didn't. That means to me that change is in the air, and I welcome it.
It's quite exciting, isn't it? Because before Jeremy Corbyn, especially for someone like myself, like I'm 25 years old, before Jeremy Corbyn, you had your high and mighty ideas, but then you had reality, which was, you know, you can think this, but then you had politicians. And Jeremy Corbyn's come along and said, hey, you know what? You know, I don't care about that. I'm going to say what I feel. I'm going to do what I want, and I'm going to see how it goes. And now he's at Glastonbury. He's got hundreds of thousands of people cheering for him. It's an exciting time.
That's true. It's a great change. Young people have traditionally been less likely to vote and more apathetic than older people. It's been the old people who dictated elections. Now, in the last election in Britain, young people turned out, they voted, and they voted Labour, and Labour did well. And we saw the same phenomenon in the States with Bernie Sanders, don't forget. It's a very similar phenomenon. An old man who's sincere and transparently honest and is more radical than the existing generation of politicians does well and gets support. I think that's a change. I hope it keeps up, actually, because we need young people to be involved if we're going to change the system. And one of the weaknesses of government up to now has been their apathy and failure to fight back. I mean, look at a generation of students that accepted student loans and high student fees. That was a terrible way of financing a higher education, and yet it was accepted with a certain amount of revolt. And now my granddaughter's just graduated here with a debt of after 3 years at university, £50,000.
With all this talk of younger voters, just on your Wikipedia page, I think it was, it says you're a Eurosceptic, because I think especially in the UK, younger people often quite identify with the European Union as being something they're a part of. But there are a lot of problems with the EU, especially I think with the euro, the currency. And I was wondering, what do you think about the UK's relationship with the EU going forward after Brexit?
Well, it's difficult to foresee what's going to happen. I think Brexit will go ahead, but that's a two-year process of negotiations, and we don't really know what's going to come out of it at the end of the 2 years. But I think there is a will there to come out. I think that's what the government is going to do. And it all depends really how tough the terms are that Europe demands for us to come out. I think, you know, everybody wants a close relation with Europe, but we had a close relationship with Europe before. I went to school in France. Peter Mayle wrote the famous books on buying a house in France and so on and so forth. So that will continue. What won't continue, I hope, is the drain. The problem with Europe is that it drains other countries economically. Germany is so successful. It builds up a huge trading surplus, the biggest surplus of any advanced country in the world. And it won't spend it and it won't redistribute it. That means that the euro ties the other countries, spectacularly Greece, but also Portugal and Spain and Italy, to deflation, to high youth unemployment and to low economic growth while Germany grows. Now, that's unfair and inequitable. It can't work. I don't see the euro working. And the problem there is whether Europe will reform itself or whether Britain's departure will force them to reform anyway. And there, I wait and see. I am suspicious of Europe. And I say, Britain betrayed New Zealand. Well, anyway, I thought New Zealand was betrayed. And certainly, I represented Grimsby, which is a fishing port. Well, fishing was badly betrayed by Europe. So from the start, I've been suspicious of Europe, call it the common market or the European Union, whatever you want. And as time passed, I've seen it as a drain on this economy. Young people are enthusiastic about Europe, naturally. I was and I am. But we've got to consider the economic consequences.
And just touching on fishing, I was wondering about your name. You're Austin Mitchell, but I believe at one point in time you were actually Austin Haddock.
Well, yeah, that's right. I did that to publicise National Fishing Week and the fishing industry generally, because the fishing industry wrote to all the MPs representing fishing ports, of which I was one, and asked them to change their names to their favourite fish as a publicity gimmick. I was the only fool who responded. Everybody else kept their head down.
So you changed your name to Austin Haddock.
My favourite fish is haddock. I'll change my name to haddock. And I did change my name to haddock. The result was I was feted with free fish and chips around the country, all over. Fish and chip shops were offering me free fish and chips. And I grew enormously fat, but I kept it up for 2 or 3 weeks, but then the House of Commons authorities, the Hansard authority, wrote to me and said, did I wish my name to be recorded as Austin Haddock in my speeches in Hansard? And at that stage, I thought I'd better change back before it got out of hand. So I changed back. I'm told now that I didn't operate in the proper legal fashion. And that legally my name is still Austin Haddock.
Oh, good on you.
I don't mind telling you in New Zealand, but I keep quiet about it here.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.